his family and friends he grieves, and is not served by those his gifts attract. No one is there, all in all, who being angry lives at ease. All these ills are brought about by wrath, our sorrow-bearing enemy. But those who seize and crush their anger down will find their joy in this and future lives. Getting what I do not want, and all that hinders my desire, in discontent my anger finds its fuel. From this it grows and beats me down. Therefore I will utterly destroy the sustenance of this my enemy, my foe who has no other purpose but to hurt and injure me. So come what may, I'll not upset my cheerful happiness of mind. Dejection never brings me what I want. My virtue will be warped and marred by it. If there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? Pain, humiliation, insults, or rebukes, we do not want them, either for ourselves or those we love. For those we do not like, it's the reverse. The cause of happiness is rare, and many are the seeds of suffering. But if I have no pain, I'll never long for freedom. Therefore, O my mind, be steadfast. The Karna folk and those devoted to the goddess endure the meaningless austerities of being cut and burned. So why am I so timid on the path of freedom? There's nothing that does not grow light through habit and familiarity. Putting up with little cares, I'll train myself to bear with great adversity. Don't I see that this is so with common irritations, bites and stings of snakes and flies, experiences of hunger and of thirst, and painful rashes on my skin? Heat and cold, the wind and rain, sickness, prison, beatings. I'll not fret about such things. To do so only aggravates my trouble. There are some whose bravery increases at the sight of their own blood, while some lose all their strength and faint when it's another's blood they see. This results from how the mind is set, in steadfastness or cowardice. And so I'll scorn all injury, and hardships I will disregard. When sorrows fall upon the wise, their minds should be serene and undisturbed. For in their war against defiled emotion, many are the hardships, as in every battle. Thinking scorn of every pain, and vanquishing such foes as hatred, these are exploits of victorious warriors. The rest is slaying what is dead already. Suffering also has its worth. Through sorrow, pride is driven out, and pity felt for those who wander in samsara. Evil is avoided. Goodness seems delightful. I am not angry with my bile and other humours, fertile source of suffering and pain. So why should living beings give offence? They likewise are impelled by circumstance. Although they are unlooked for, undesired, these ills afflict us all the same. And likewise, though unwanted and unsought, defilements nonetheless insistently arise. Never thinking, now I will be angry, people are impulsively caught up in anger. Irritation likewise comes, though never plans to be experienced. All defilements of whatever kind, the whole variety of evil deeds, are brought about by circumstances. None is independent, none autonomous. Conditions, once assembled, have no thought that they will now give rise to some result. Nor does that which is engendered think that it has been produced. The primal substance, as they say, and that which has been called the self, do not arise designedly, and do not think, I will become. For that which is not born does not exist, so what could want to come to be? And permanently drawn towards its object, it can never cease from being so. Indeed, this self, if permanent, is certainly inert, like space itself. And should it meet with other factors, how could they affect it, since it is unchanging? If when conditions act on it, it stays just as it was before, what influence have these conditions had? They say that these are agents of the self, but what connection could there be between them? All things, then, depend on other things, and these likewise depend, they are not independent. Knowing this, we will not be annoyed by things that are like magical appearances. Resistance, you may say, is out of place, for what will be opposed by whom? The stream of sorrow is cut through by patience. There is nothing out of place in our assertion. Thus, when enemies or friends are seen to act improperly, remain serene and call to mind that everything arises from conditions. If things could be according to their wish, no suffering would ever come to any one of all embodied beings, for none of them wants pain of any kind. Yet carelessly, all unaware, they tear themselves on thorns, and ardent in pursuit of wives and goods, they starve themselves of nourishment. Some hang themselves, or leap into the void, take poison, or consume unhealthy food, or by their evil conduct bring destruction on themselves. For when affliction seizes them, they even slay themselves, the selves they love so much. So how can they not be the cause of others' bodily distress? Although we almost never feel compassion for those who through defilement bring about their own perdition, what purpose does our anger serve? If those who are like wanton children are by nature prone to injure others, there's no reason for our rage. It's like resenting fire for being hot. And if their faults are fleeting and contingent, if living beings are by nature mild, it's likewise senseless to resent them, as well be angry at the sky when it is full of smoke. Although it is their sticks that hurt me, I am angry at the ones who wield them, striking me. But they in turn are driven by their hatred, therefore with their hatred I should take offence. In just the same way in the past, I it was who injured living beings. Therefore it is right that injury should come to me, their torturer. Their weapons and my body, both are causes of my torment. They their weapons, I my body brandished. Who then is more worthy of my rage? This body running sore in human form, merely touched it cannot stand the pain. I'm the one who grasped it in my blind attachment. Whom should I resent when pain occurs? We who are like children shrink from pain but love its causes. We hurt ourselves through our misdeeds. So why should others be the object of our rage? And who indeed should I be angry with? This pain is all my own contriving, likewise all the janitors of hell and all the groves of razor trees. Those who harm me rise against me. It's my karma that has summoned them. And if through this these beings go to hell, is it not I who bring their ruin? Because of them, and through my patience, all my many sins are cleansed and purified. But they will be the ones who, thanks to me, will have the long-drawn agonies of hell. Therefore I am their tormentor, therefore it is they who bring me benefit. Thus with what perversity, pernicious mind, will you be angry with your enemies? If a patient quality of mind is mine, I shall avoid the pains of hell. But though indeed I save myself, what of my foes? What fate's in store for them? If I repay them harm for harm, indeed they'll not be saved thereby. My conduct will in turn be marred, austerity of patience brought to nothing. Because the mind is bodiless, it cannot be destroyed by anyone. Because of mind's attachment to the body, this body is oppressed by pain. Scorn and hostile words, and comments that I do not like to hear, my body is not harmed by them. What reason do you have, O mind, for your resentment? The enmity that others show me, since in this or future lives it cannot actually devour me, why should I be so averse to it? Perhaps I turn from it because it hinders me from having what I want. But all my property I'll leave behind, while sins will keep me steady company. Better far for me to die today than live a long and evil life. However long the days of those like me, the pain of dying will be all the same. One man dreams he lives 100 years of happiness, but then he wakes. Another dreams an instant's joy, but then he likewise wakes. And when they wake, the happiness of both is finished, never to return. Likewise, when the hour of death comes round, Our lives are over, whether brief or long. Though we be rich in worldly goods, delighting in our wealth for many years, despoiled and stripped as though by thieves, we must go naked and with empty hands. Perhaps we'll claim that by our wealth we live, and living gather merit, dissipating evil. But if we are aggressive for the sake of profit, won't our gains be evil, all our merits lost? And if the aim for which we live is thereby wasted and undone, what use is there in living thus, when evil is the only consequence? And if, when people slander us, we claim our anger is because they injure others, how is it we do not resent their slander when it's aimed at someone else? And if we bear with this antipathy because it's due to other factors, why are we impatient when they slander us? Defilement, after all, has been the cause of it. Even those who vilify and undermine the sacred doctrine, images, and stupas are not proper objects of our anger. Buddhas are themselves untouched thereby. And even if our teachers, relatives, and friends are now the object of aggression, all derives from factors, as we have explained. This we should perceive and curb our wrath. Beings suffer injury alike from lifeless things as well as living beings. So why be angry only with the latter? Rather, let us simply bear with harm. Some do evil things because of ignorance. Some respond with anger, being ignorant. Which of them is faultless in such acts? To whom shall error be ascribed? Instead, why did they act in times gone by that they are now so harmed at others' hands? Since everything depends on karma, why should I be angry at such things? This I see, and therefore, come what may, I'll hold fast to the virtuous path, and foster in the hearts of all an attitude of mutual love. Now when a building is ablaze, and flames leap out from house to house, the wise course is to take and fling away the straw and anything that spreads the fire. And so, in fear that merit might be all consumed, we should at once cast far away our mind's attachments, tinder for the fiery flames of hate. Is it not a happy chance if, when condemned to death, a man is freed, his hand cut off in ransom for his life? And is it not a happy chance if now, to escape hell, I suffer only the misfortunes of the human state? If even these, my present pains, are now beyond my strength to bear, why do I not cast off my anger, cause of future sorrows in infernal torment? For sake of gaining all that I desired, 1,000 times I underwent the tortures of the realms of hell, achieving nothing for myself and others. The present aches are nothing to compare with those, and yet great benefits will come from them. These troubles that dispel the pain of wanderers, it's only right that I rejoice in them. When others take delight in giving praise to those endowed with talents, why, O mind, do you not find a joy likewise in praising them? The pleasure that is gained therefrom itself gives rise to blameless happiness. It's urged on us by all the holy ones, and is the perfect way of winning others. But they're the ones who'll have the happiness, you say. If this, then, is a joy you would resent, abandon paying wages and returning favours, you will be the loser, both in this life and the next. When praise is heaped upon your qualities, you're keen that others should be pleased thereby. But when the compliment is paid to others, you feel no inclination to rejoice as well. You who want the happiness of beings have wished to be enlightened for their sake. So why should others irk you when they find some pleasure for themselves? And if you claim to wish that beings be enlightened, honoured by the triple world, when petty marks of favour come their way, why are you so discomforted? When dependents who rely on you, to whom you are obliged to give support, find for themselves the means of livelihood, will you not be happy? Will you once again be angry? If even this you do not want for beings, how could you want Buddhahood for them? And how can anyone have bodhicitta who is angry when another prospers? If someone else receives a gift, or if that gift stays in the benefactor's house, in neither case will it be yours. So given or withheld, why is it your concern? All your merit and the faith of others, all your sterling qualities, why throw them all away? Not holding on to what might bring you riches, tell me, why are you not angry at yourself? Not only do you feel no sorrow for the evils you have done, you even wish to match yourself with those whose merit has been earned. If unhappiness befalls your enemies, why should this be cause for your rejoicing? The wishes of your mind alone will not in fact contrive their injury. And if your hostile wishes were to bring them harm, again, what cause of joy is that to you? Why then I would be satisfied. Are these your thoughts? Is anything more ruinous than that? Caught upon the hook, unbearable and sharp, cast by the fishermen my own defilements, I'll be flung into the cauldrons of the pit, and surely boiled by all the janitors of hell. Veneration, praise, and fame serve not to increase merit or my span of life, bestowing neither health nor strength, and nothing for the body's ease. If I am wise in what is good for me, I'll ask what benefit these bring. And if it's entertainment I desire, I might as well resort to alcohol and cards. I lose my life, my wealth I squander, all for reputation's sake. What use are words, and whom will they delight, when I am dead and in my grave? Children can't help crying when their sandcastles come crumbling down. My mind is so like them, when praise and reputation start to fail. Short-lived sound, devoid of intellect, can never in itself intend to praise me. I say that it's the joy that others take in me. It's this that is the cause of my delight. But what is it to me if others take delight in someone else or even in myself? Their pleasure's theirs, and theirs alone. No part of it is felt by me. If I am happy at the joy of those who take delight, then everyone should be a source of joy to me. When people take delight in others, why am I not happy at their pleasure? The satisfaction that is mine from thinking I am being praised is unacceptable to common sense, and nothing but the antics of a silly child. Praise and compliments distract me, sapping my revulsion with samsara. I start to envy others their good qualities, and thus all excellence is ruined. Those who stay close by me, then, to damage my good name and cut me down to size, are surely there protecting me from falling into realms of grief. For I am one who strives for freedom. I must not be caught by wealth and honours. How could I be angry with the ones who work to free me from my fetters? They, like Buddha's very blessing, bar my way, determined as I am to plunge myself headlong in sorrow. How can I be angry with them? I should not be irritated saying they are obstacles to my good deeds, for is not patience the supreme austerity, and should I not abide by this? And if I fail to practice patience, hindered by my own shortcomings, I myself create impediments to merit's causes yet so close at hand. If something does not come to be when something else is absent, and does arise that factor being present, that factor is indeed its cause. How can it then be said to hinder it? The beggars who arrive at proper times are not an obstacle to generosity. We cannot say that those who give the vows are hindrances to ordination. The beggars in this world are numerous. Assailants are comparatively few. For if I do no harm to others, others do no injury to me. So like a treasure found at home that I have gained without fatigue, my enemies are helpers in my bodhisattva work, and therefore they should be a joy to me. Since I have grown in patience thanks to them its first fruits I should give, for of my patience they have been the cause. And if I say my foes should not be honoured, since they did not mean to stimulate my patience, why do I revere the sacred Dharma, cause indeed of my attainment? These enemies conspired to harm me, I protest. and therefore should receive no honors. But had they worked to help me like a doctor, how could I have brought forth patience? Thanks to those whose minds are full of malice, I engender patience in myself. They therefore are the causes of my patience, fit for veneration like the Dharma. And so the mighty sage has spoken of the field of beings, as well as of the field of conquerors. Many who brought happiness to beings have passed beyond attaining to perfection. Thus the state of Buddhahood depends on beings and on Buddhas equally. What kind of practice is it then that honors only Buddhas but not beings? Not in the qualities of their minds, but in the fruits they give are they alike. In beings too such excellence resides, and therefore beings and Buddhas are the same. Offerings made to those with loving minds reveal the eminence of living beings. Merit that accrues from faith in Buddha shows in turn the Buddha's eminence. Although not one of them is equal to the Buddhas who are oceans of perfection, because they have a share in bringing forth enlightenment, beings may be likened to the Buddhas. If of such a gathering of supreme excellence a tiny part appeared in certain beings, the three worlds made in offering to them would be a very little thing. Since there lies in beings a share in bringing forth the supreme and enlightened state, by virtue of this parity alone, it's right that I should reverence them. The Buddhas are my true, unfailing friends. Boundless are the benefits they bring to me. How else may I repay their goodness but by making living beings happy? By helping beings, I repay the ones who sacrifice their lives for us and plunge into the hell of unrelenting pain. Should beings therefore do great harm to me, I'll strive to bring them only benefit. For those who have become my lords at times took care not even of their bodies. Why should I, a fool, behave with such conceit? Why should I not become the slave of others? Buddhas are made happy by the joy of beings. They sorrow, they lament when beings suffer. By bringing joy to beings, then, I please the Buddhas also. By wounding them, I wound the Buddhas too. Just as there's no sensual delight to please the mind of one whose body burns in fire, there is no way to please the great compassionate ones while we ourselves are causes of another's pain. The damage I have done to beings saddens all the Buddhas in their great compassion. Therefore all these evils I confess today, and pray that they will bear with my offences. That I might rejoice the Buddha's hearts, henceforth I will be master of myself, the servant of the world. I shall not seek revenge, though crowds may trample on my head or kill me. Let the guardians of the world rejoice. The great compassionate lords consider as themselves all beings. There's no doubt of this. Those whom I perceive as beings are Buddhas in themselves. How can I not treat them with respect? This very thing is pleasing to the Buddha's hearts, and perfectly secures the welfare of myself. This will drive away the sorrows of the world, and therefore it will be my constant work. Imagine that the steward of a king does injury to multitudes of people. Those with clear, far-seeing eyes do not respond with violence, even if they can. For stewards, after all, are not alone. They are supported by the kingly power. Therefore I will not despise the feeble beings tormenting me. Their allies are the guardians of hell and also the compassionate Buddhas. Therefore living beings I will gratify, as subjects might placate a wrathful king. And yet the pains of hell to be endured through making living beings suffer, could these ever be unleashed on me by all the ire of such a king? And even if that king were pleased, enlightenment he could not give to me. For this will only be achieved by bringing happiness to beings. No need to mention future Buddhahood, achieved through bringing happiness to beings. How can I not see that glory, fame, and pleasure, even in this life, will likewise come? For patience in samsara brings such things as beauty, health, and good renown. Its fruit is great longevity, the vast contentment of a universal king. Chapter 7. Diligence. Thus with patience I will strive with diligence, for in such diligence enlightenment is found. If no wind blows, then nothing stirs, and neither is there merit without diligence. Diligence means joy in virtuous ways. Its contraries have been defined as laziness, an inclination for unwholesomeness, defeatism, and self-contempt. A taste for idle pleasure, and a craving for repose and sleep. No qualms about the sorrows of samsara. Laziness indeed is born from these. Snared by the trapper of defiled emotion, enmeshed and taken in the toils of birth, again you've strayed into the maw of death. What is it? Have you still not understood? Don't you see how one by one death has come for all your kind, and yet you slumber on so soundly like a buffalo beside its butcher? All the paths of flight are blocked. The Lord of Death now has you in his sights. How can you take such pleasure in your food? And how can you delight to rest and sleep? Death will swoop on you so swiftly. Gather merit till that moment comes. For even if you then throw off your indolence, what will you do when there is no more time? This I have not done, and this I'm only starting, and this I'm only halfway through. Then is the sudden coming of the Lord of Death, and oh, the thought, alas, I'm finished. You'll look upon the faces of your hopeless friends, their tear-stained cheeks, their red and swollen eyes, for such will be the depths of their distress, and then you'll see the heralds of the deadly Lord. The memory of former sins will torture you, the screams and din of hell break on your ears. With very terror you will foul yourself. What will you do in such delirium? If like a living fish that twists and writhes, you are so terrified while still alive, what need to speak of pain unbearable in hells created by past evil deeds? How can you remain at ease like this, when you have done the deeds that lead to contact on your tender baby flesh of boiling liquids in the hell of extreme heat? So testy and thin-skinned, you want results without endeavour. Many are the troubles now in store for you. Though in the grip of death, you are behaving like a god, and suffering, alas, will beat you down. So take advantage of this human boat. Free yourself from sorrow's mighty stream. This vessel will be later hard to find. The time that you have now, you fool, is not for sleep. You turn your back upon the sacred doctrine, supreme joy and boundless source of bliss. Why delight in mere excitement, in distractions that will cause you misery? Do not be downcast, but marshal all your powers. Make an effort, be the master of yourself. Practice the equality of self and other. Practice the exchange of self and other. Oh, but how could I become enlightened? Don't excuse yourself with such despondency. The Buddha who declares the truth has truly spoken and proclaimed that if they bring forth strength of perseverance, even bees and flies and gnats and grubs will gain supreme enlightenment so hard to find. And if by birth and lineage of humankind I'm able to distinguish good from ill, and do not leave aside the bodhisattva deeds, why should I not attain the state of Buddhahood? That I must give away my life and limbs alarms and frightens me. If so you say, your terror is misplaced. Confused, you fail to see what's hard and what is easy. For myriads of ages, measureless, uncounted, your body has been cut, impaled, burned, torn, for times past numbering. Yet none of this has brought you Buddhahood. The hardships suffered on the path to Buddhahood are limited in their extent and likened to the pain of an incision made to cure the harms of inward ills. And all our doctors cure disease by means of bitter remedies. Likewise, to destroy a vast amount of pain, we should be patient with our little hurts. And yet the Supreme Healer does not use, like them, these common remedies. With ways of extreme tenderness, he soothes away intense and boundless suffering. Our guide instructs us to begin by giving vegetable greens or other little things, that later, step by step, the habit once acquired, we may be able to donate our very flesh. For when we truly feel our bodies are no different from the given herbs, what hardship can there be in giving up, relinquishing our very flesh? Sin has been abandoned, thus there is no pain. Through having wisdom there is no more sorrow. For so it is that mind and body both are injured by false views and sinfulness. Merit is the true cause of the body's ease, while happiness of mind is had through understanding. What can sadden those who have compassion, who remain within samsara for the sake of beings? For through their power of bodhicitta, former sins are totally consumed, and merit, ocean vast, is gathered in. It's therefore said that they excel the Shravakas. Mounted on the horse of bodhicitta, which puts to flight all mournful weariness, what lucid person could be in despair, proceeding in this way from joy to joy? The forces that secure the good of beings are aspiration, steadfastness, relinquishment, and joy. Aspiration grows through fear of suffering and contemplation of the benefits to be attained. Therefore, leaving everything that is averse to it, I'll labor to increase my diligence, through aspiration and self-confidence, relinquishment and joy, by strength of earnest application and exertion of control. The boundless evils of myself and others, I must bring them all to nothing, even though a single of these ills may take unnumbered ages to exhaust. And if I find within myself no sign that faults are even starting to be cleansed, why does my heart not burst asunder, destined as I am for boundless pain? Good qualities for my and others' sake, though they be many, I must now accomplish, even though for each of them I must endeavour for unnumbered ages. Acquaintance I have never gained with even part of such great qualities. It is indeed amazing that I render meaningless this life that somehow I have gained. Offerings to the Buddhas I have never made. No feasts were held through my donations. No works have I accomplished for the teachings. The wishes of the poor I left unsatisfied. I have not saved the frightened from their fear. The wretched I have not consoled. My mother's pain, her womb's discomfort, these alone are my accomplishments. My failure to aspire to Dharma now and in the past has brought me to my present dereliction. Who, therefore, would spurn such aspiration? Aspiration, so the sage asserted, is the root of every kind of virtue. Aspiration's root, in turn, is constant meditation on the fruits of action. The body's pains, anxieties of mind, and all my fears of various kinds, to be deprived of what I want, such is the harvest of my sinful deeds. But if my acts are good, sincerely intended, then no matter where I turn my steps, the merit gained will honour me with its resulting benefits. But if, through seeking happiness, my deeds are wrong, no matter where I turn my steps, the knives of misery will cut me down, the wage and retribution of a sinful life. Through virtue I will rest within the cool heart of a fragrant spreading lotus, with splendour nurtured by the sweet words of the conqueror. Then from the lotus opened in the sage's light, in supreme form I will arise, to dwell the blissful Buddha's air, in presence of victorious ones. Or else, as wages of my many sins, my skin completely flayed, I shall be utterly brought low by creatures of the Lord of Death, who on my body pour a liquid bronze all melted in the dreadful blaze. And pierced by burning swords and knives, my flesh dismembered in 100 parts will fall upon the white-hot iron ground. Therefore I will aspire and tend to virtue, and steep myself in it with great devotion. And with the method stated in the Vajradvaja, I will train in confident assurance. Let me first consider my reserves, to start or not to start accordingly. It might be better not to start, but once begun, I should not then withdraw. For if I do such things, the pattern will return in later lives, and sin and pain will grow, and other actions will be left undone, or else will bear a meager fruit. Action, the afflictions and ability, three things to which my pride should be directed. I will do this, I myself alone. These words define my pride of action. Overpowered by their mind's afflictions, worldly folk are helpless to secure their happiness. Compared with those who wander, I am able. This, therefore, shall be my task. When others give themselves to low behavior, what shall be my stance in their regard? In any case, I'll not be arrogant. My best way is to give up such conceit. When they find a dying serpent, even crows behave like soaring eagles. Therefore, if I'm weak and feeble-hearted, even little faults will strike and injure me. But if, depressed, I give up trying, how can I gain freedom from my abject state? But if I stand my ground with proud resolve, it will be hard for even great faults to attack me. Therefore, with a steadfast heart, I'll get the better of my weaknesses. But if my failings get the upper hand, my wish to overcome the triple world is laughable indeed. I will be victor over all, and nothing shall prevail and bring me down. The offspring of the lion, the conqueror, should constantly abide in this self-confidence. Those whom arrogance destroys are thus defiled. They lack self-confidence. Those who have true confidence escape the foe, while others fall into the power of an evil pride. When arrogance inflates the mind, it draws it down to states of misery, or ruins happiness should human birth be gained. Thus one is born a slave, dependent for one's sustenance, or feeble-minded, ugly, without strength, the butt and laughing-stock of everyone. These ascetics puffed up with conceit. If these you call the proud, then tell me who are wretched. Those who uphold pride to vanquish pride the enemy are truly proud, victorious and brave. And they who stem the increase of that evil pride perfect, according to their wish, the fruit of victory for beings. When I am beleaguered by defilements, I will stand and face them in a thousand ways. I'll not surrender to the host of the afflictions, but like a lion I will stand amid a crowd of foxes. However great may be their peril, people will by reflex guard their eyes. And likewise I, whatever dangers come, must not fall down beneath defilement's power. Better for me to be burned to death, and better to be killed, my head cut off. At no time will I bow and scrape before that foe of mine, defiled emotion. Thus in every time and place I will not wander from the wholesome path. Like those who take great pleasure in their games, whatever task the bodhisattvas do, let them devote themselves without reserve, with joyfulness that never knows satiety. People labor hard to gain contentment, though success is very far from sure. But how can they be happy if they do not do those deeds that are the source of joy to them? And since they never have enough of pleasure, honey on the razor's edge, how could they have enough of merit, fruits of which are happiness and peace? The elephant, tormented by the noonday sun, will dive into the waters of a lake, and likewise I must plunge into my work, that I might bring it to completion. If impaired by weakness or fatigue, I'll lay the work aside, the better to resume. And I will leave the task when it's complete, all avid for the work that's next to come. As seasoned fighters face the swords of enemies upon the battle line, I'll lightly dodge the weapons of defilement and strike my enemy upon the quick. If in the fray the soldier drops his sword, in fright he quickly takes it up again. So likewise, if the arm of mindfulness is lost, in fear of hell I'll quickly get it back. Just as poison fills the body borne on the current of the blood, likewise evil, when it finds its chance, will spread and permeate the mind. I will be like a frightened man, a brimming oil jar in his hand, and menaced by a swordsman saying, "Spill one drop and you shall die." This is how practitioners should hold themselves. Just as a man would swiftly stand if in his lap a serpent were to glide, if sleep and lethargy beset me, I will speedily repulse them. Every time, then, that I fail, I will reprove and chide myself, thinking long that by whatever means, such faults in future shall no more occur. At all times and in any situation, how can I make mindfulness my constant habit? Thinking thus, I will desire to meet with teachers and fulfill the proper tasks. By all means, then, before I start some work, that I might have the strength sufficient to the task, I will recall the teachings upon carefulness, and lightly rise to what is to be done. Just as flaxen threads waft to and fro, impelled by every breath of wind, so all I do will be achieved, controlled by movements of a joyful heart. Chapter 8. Meditative Concentration. Cultivating diligence, as just described, in concentration I will place my mind. For those whose minds are slack and wandering are caught between the fangs of the afflictions. In solitude the mind and body are not troubled by distraction. Therefore leave this worldly life and totally abandon mental wandering. Because of loved ones and desire for gain, we fail to turn away from worldly things. These, then, are the first things to renounce. The prudent should conduct themselves like this. Penetrative insight, joined with calm abiding, utterly eradicates afflicted states. Knowing this, first search for calm abiding, found by people who are happy to be free from worldly ties. Beings, brief, ephemeral, who strongly cling to what is also transient, will catch no glimpse of those they love for many thousands of their future lives. Not seeing them, their minds will have no joy. They therefore will not rest in equanimity. But even if they see them, they are not content, and as before, the pain of longing stays. If I crave for other beings, a veil is cast upon the perfect truth. Wholesome disillusion melts away, and finally there comes the sting of pain. My thoughts are all for them, and thus my life is frittered by. My family and friends all change and pass, for whom the changeless Dharma is cast out. For if I act like childish beings, sure it is that I shall fall to evil destinies. So why do I keep company with infants, who lead me to a state so far from virtue? One moment friends, the next their bitter enemies. Even pleasant things arouse their discontent. Ordinary people, it is hard to please them. A beneficial word and they resent it, turning me instead from what is good. And when I close my ears to what they say, their anger makes them fall to lower states. Jealous of superiors, they vie with equals. Proud to those below, they strut when praised. Say something untoward, they seethe with rage. What good was ever had from childish folk? Keep company with them, and what will follow? Self-aggrandizement and scorn for others. Talk about the good things of samsara. Every kind of vice is sure to come. Only ruin can result from such a link between myself and others, for they will bring no benefit to me, and I in turn can do them nothing good. Therefore flee the company of childish people. Greet them when you meet with smiles that keep on terms of common courtesy, without inviting intimate relations. Like bees that get their honey from the flowers, take only what will serve the practice of the Dharma. Treat everyone like new acquaintances, and keep yourself from close familiarity. Oh, I am rich and well respected. Lots of people take delight in me. Nourish such complacency, and later, after death, your fears will start. Indeed, O foolish and afflicted mind, you want and crave for all and everything. All this together will rise up as pain itself, increased 1,000-fold. Since this is so, the wise have no attachments. From such cravings fear and anguish come, and fix this firmly in your understanding, all that may be wished for will by nature fade to nothing. For people may have gained great wealth of riches, enjoying reputation, sweet renown. But who can say where they have gone to now, with all the baggage of their gold and fame? Why should I be pleased when people praise me? Others there will be who scorn and criticize. And why despondent when I'm blamed, since there'll be others who think well of me? So many are the leanings and the wants of beings, that even Buddha could not please them all. Of such a wretch as me, no need to speak. I'll give up such concerns with worldly things. People scorn the poor who have no wealth. They also criticize the rich who have it. What pleasure can derive from keeping company with people such as these, so difficult to please? In kindness, childish beings take no delight unless their own desires are satisfied. A childish person thus is no true friend. This the Tathagatas have declared. In woodlands, haunt of stag and bird, among the trees where no dissension jars, it's there I would keep pleasant company. When might I be off to make my dwelling there? When shall I depart to make my home, in cave or empty shrine or under spreading tree, with in my breast a free, unfettered heart, which never turns to cast a backward glance? When might I abide in such a place unclaimed and ownerless, that's wide and unconfined, a place where I might stay at liberty without attachment? When might I be free of fear, without the need to hide from anyone, with just a begging bowl and few belongings, dressed in garments coveted by none? And going to the charnel ground, when shall I compare my body with the dry bones there, so soon to fall to nothing all alike? This form of mine, this very flesh, is soon to give out such a stench that even jackals won't come close, and that indeed is all it will become. This body, now so whole and integral, this flesh and bone that life has knit together, will drift apart, disintegrate, and how much more will friend depart from friend? Alone we are born, alone we come into the world, and when we die, alone we pass away. No one shares our fate, and none our suffering. What need have I of friends who hinder me? Like those who journey on the road, who pause and lodge along the way, beings on the pathways of existence seize upon the lodging of their birth. Until the time comes round when four men carry me away, amid the grief of worldly folk, till then I will away and go into the forest. There, with no befriending or begrudging, I will stay alone in solitude, considered from the outset as already dead, thus, when I die, a source of pain to none. Then there will be no one standing by, in tears and mourning, thus to trouble me, and no one will be there distracting me from thinking of the Buddha and the practice. Therefore, in these lovely gleaming woods, with joy that's marred by few concerns, where mental wandering will cease, I will remain in blissful solitude, relinquishing all other aspirations, focusing myself on one intent alone. I'll strive to still my mind, and calming it to bring it to subjection. In this and in the worlds to come, desires the parent of all woe. In this world killing bonds and wounds, and in the next the hells and other pains. You send your go-betweens, both boy and maid, with many invitations for the prize, avoiding in the quest no sin, no deed that brings an ill renown, nor acts of frightful risk, nor loss of ruin and possessions, all for pleasure and the perfect bliss, that utmost penetrating kiss of what in truth is nothing but a heap of bones, devoid of self, without autonomy. Is this the only object of desire and lust? Sooner pass beyond all suffering and grief. What pains you went to just to lift her face that modestly looked down, which looked upon or not before was always with a veil concealed. That face for which you languished so, well, here it is, now nakedly exposed. The vultures have uncovered it for you to see. What's this? You run away so soon? That which once you jealously protected, shielded from the eyes of other men. Why, miser that you are, don't you protect it, now that it's the food of graveyard birds? Look, this mass of human flesh is now the fare of carrion beasts. And you would deck with garlands, sandalwood and jewels, the food and provender of others? Look again, this heap of bones, inert and dead. Why, what are you so scared of? Why did you not fear it when it walked around, just like a risen corpse propelled by some strange influence? You loved it once, when clothed and draped it was. Well, now it's naked, why do you not want it? Ah, you say, your need is no more there. But why did you embrace it all bedecked and covered? From food, a single source, come equally the body's filth and nectar of the mouth. So why are you delighted by saliva, and yet repelled by excrement? Taking no delight in pillows made of cotton soft to touch, you claim the human form emits no stench. Befooled by lust, its filth you do not recognize. Lustful one, befuddled by desire, because you cannot copulate with it, you angrily find fault with cotton, soft though it may be to touch. And if you have no love of filth, how can you coddle on your lap a cage of bones tied fast with sinews, plastered over with the mud of flesh? In fact, you're full of filth yourself. You wallow in it constantly. It is indeed just filth that you desire, and therefore long for other sacks of it. But it's the skin and flesh I love to touch and look upon. Then why do you not wish for flesh alone, inanimate and in its natural state? The mind that you perhaps desire, you cannot hold or look upon. Whatever you can hold or see is not the mind. Why copulate with something it is not? To fail to grasp the unclean nature of another's flesh is not perhaps so strange. But not to see the filthy nature of oneself is very strange indeed. Why does the mind, intent on filthiness, neglect the fresh young lotus blossom opened in the sunlight of a cloudless sky, to take joy rather in a sack of dirt? And since you're disinclined to touch a place or object grimed with excrement, why do you wish to touch the body when such excrement has come? And if you have no craving for impurity, why will you now embrace and kiss what comes from such an unclean place, engendered likewise from an unclean seed? The tiny fetid worms that come from filth, you have no love for them. And yet you're lusting for a human form, from filth arisen and replete with it. Toward your own impurity, disgust you do not feel, and yearning and athirst for filth, you long for other sacks of it. Pleasant substances like camphor, rice, and fresh green herbs, put them in your mouth and spit them out, the earth itself is fouled thereby. If still you doubt such filthiness, though it is very plain for all to see, go off into the charnel grounds, observe the fetid bodies there abandoned. When their skins are peeled away, you feel great horror and revulsion. Now that you have understood, how can you still take joy in such a thing? The scent that now perfumes the skin is sandalwood and nothing else. Yet how is it that one thing's fragrance causes you to long for something else? Is it not best to have no lust for something that by nature stinks? The worldly crave beside their purpose. Why do they anoint their flesh with pleasant scents? For if this scent is sandalwood, how can it be the perfume of the body? How is it that the fragrance of a thing induces you to crave for something else? With lanky hair, with long nails overgrown, with dirty teeth all reeking with the stink of slime, this body, naked as it is untended, is indeed a horror to behold. Why go to such excess to clean and polish what is but a weapon that will injure you? The cares that people squander on themselves in ignorance convulse the universe with madness. When you saw the heaps of human bones, you felt revulsion in the charnel ground. And will you take delight in cities of the dead frequented by such skeletons that live and move? What's more, possession of another's filth is not to be acquired free of charge. All is at a price, exhaustion in this life, and in the next, the suffering of hell. To gather riches young boys are unable, and what can they enjoy when they're full grown? The whole of life is spent in gaining wealth, but then they're old, too old to satisfy their lust. Some are wretched in their great desire, but worn out by their day-long work, they go home broken by fatigue to sleep the slumbers of a corpse. Some, wearied by their travels far from home, must suffer separation from their wives and children whom they love and long to see. They do not meet with them for years on end. Some, ambitious for prosperity, not knowing how to get it, sell themselves. Happiness eludes their grasp, and pointlessly they live and labor for their masters. Some sell themselves, no longer free, in bondage, slavery to others. And destitute, their wives give birth with only trees for shelter in the wild. Fools, deceived by craving for a livelihood, decide that they will make their fortune in the wars, though fearful for their lives. And seeking gain, it's slavery they get. Some, as a result of craving, have their bodies slashed, impaled on pointed stakes. Some are wounded, run through by the lance, while some are put to death by fire. The pain of gaining, keeping, and of losing all, see the endless hardships brought on us by property. For those distracted by their love of wealth, there is no chance for freedom from the sorrows of existence. They, indeed, possessed of many wants, will suffer many troubles, all for very little. They're like the ox that pulls the cart and catches bits of grass along the way. For sake of such a paltry thing, which is not rare, which even beasts can find, tormented by their karma, they destroy this precious human life so hard to find. All that we desire is sure to perish, on which account we fall to hellish pain. For what amounts to very little, we must suffer constant and exhausting weariness. With but a millionth part of such vexation, enlightenment itself could be attained. Those who crave are plagued far more than those engaged upon the path, yet Buddhahood is not what they attain. Reflect upon the pains of hell and other evil states, weapons, fires and poisons, yawning chasms, hostile foes. None is on a level with our cravings. So, revolted by our lust and wanting, let us now rejoice in solitude, in places empty of all conflict and defilement, the peace and stillness of the forest. Happy those intent on others' good, who roam in pleasant places formed of massive stone, refreshed by moonlight sandal-scented beams, by gentle woodland breezes soothed. In caves beneath the trees, in houses left abandoned, may we linger long as we might wish. Relinquishing the pain of guarding our possessions, let us live in freedom, unconfined by cares. To have such liberty unmarred by craving, loosed from every bond and tie, a life of such contentment and such pleasure, even Indra would be pressed to find. Reflecting in such ways as these, upon the excellence of solitude, pacify completely all discursiveness, and cultivate the mind of bodhicitta. Strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow all are equal. Thus be guardian of all, as of yourself. The hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, the body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. This pain of mine does not afflict or cause discomfort to another's body, and yet this pain is hard for me to bear, because I cling and take it for my own. And other beings' pain I do not feel, and yet because I take them for myself, their suffering is mine, and therefore hard to bear. And therefore I'll dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain, just like my